Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Hey, everybody. What's up, monkeys? Here we are at Snark Monkey number 36, I want to say. That's probably right. You know, I wish my producer would prep me on things like that before we get started. I don't have a producer. There is none. I'm entirely relying on myself, and that's dangerous. So here we go, Yakov Smirnoff. Now, if you had told me, any time in my life, yeah, you're going to get to know Yakov Smirnoff a little bit, I would have gone, what a country. I'm sorry. That, of course, is his catchphrase, made very popular in the 80s when he was maybe one of the most high-profile comedians anywhere. He was on TV, he was in movies, he was doing live stand-up, he was doing a Miller Lite commercial, for crying out loud. He was everywhere, playing The Tonight Show. He had a very specific kind of material and act that was built around the Cold War. The fact that he did come from Russia, grew up there, was educated there, came to America, learned English from scratch while he was here, learned to be a comedian but while being around other comedians, was very much a part of the Comedy Store as it was coming into its own as a major place for the next big names in stand-up comedy. He's been through it all, seen it all, and then saw his career go tumbling down, and he had to build himself, his life, his career, his relationship back up again. And it's a pretty great story. Now, I talk about this early on with Yakov once we get started here, but I would highly recommend, if you have access to Mark Maron's podcast, to go back and listen to the conversation he had with Yakov, I believe at the end of 2013. This kind of serves as a continuation or a companion piece to that, if you get a chance to listen to it. I don't focus as much on the early years, the Comedy Store years, as Maron does, because that's right in his wheelhouse. That's when Maron was, you know, that was part of his history. I talk a little bit more about what Yakov is doing now, because he went on to get an Ivy League education to learn something that he had a real fascination with. And, oh, and by the way, I recognize in this episode, I say the word fascinating a lot. At one point, I was literally considering cutting out a few of the times I say, that's fascinating. That's so fascinating. I find it fascinating. I think there was a point where I say it three times within 45 seconds. So please, I recognize that I'm saying it. So you don't have to point it out on the comments and the thing and the deal. I get it. I'm working on it. But anyway, this is a fascinating conversation with someone who was an iconic stand-up comic through the culture of current events in the 80s and into the 90s, had to completely change his perspective, his point of view, his life, his career, and also wanted to recognize why, personally, one relationship fell apart and how that spoke to what the next phase of his life was going to be about, both personally and professionally. This guy's really smart, still really, really funny, still performing to this day. As a matter of fact, here comes the plug portion of the intro, which I probably should have done a long time ago, but I was fascinated with my own voice. Yakov Smirnoff will be performing at the Saban Theater in Beverly Hills next week as of this posting, August 16th. Then he'll be headed back to Branson, Missouri, where he has his own theater. He's been doing that for a number of years now, filling the place, a 2,000-seat theater. He'll be doing 52 shows there between the end of September and beginning of December, if you happen to find yourself in the Ozarks. And then we talk about this later, but a PBS special called Happily Ever Laughter, based upon his new philosophy, his new material, his new goal in life. They'll be recording that special in Escondido at the Escondido Performing Arts Center on September 26th, and it will air in March of next year. And you can get all that info and keep an eye on his tour dates and what Yaakov is up to at yaakov.com. All right, let's get to it. Snark Monkey number 36-ish, I think. I need a producer. Here is Yaakov Smirnoff. Enjoy. One of the things I want this to be, because you and I have talked about this, Yaakov, your Marc Maron podcast, which I thought was fascinating.
Yes.
I almost want to send people off, go listen to that one.
Oh, okay.
And now listen to this one. This could be like a part two, because
sure.
He was fascinated because of his perspective, especially with his history with the Comedy Store. He was fascinated with kind of your early years.
Yes, yes.
But I really want to concentrate on kind of what you're focusing on now, because it's fascinating.
Thank you.
Well, we'll find out.
Yeah.
Other people will judge
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Let me get a little bit of background, because you
sure.
and I, this is the, I will probably try and not make jokes during this, because you're much funnier than I am.
Oh, don't worry. You go for it. If it feels right, go for it.
But you and I have something in common. Where did you grow up?
Odessa.
Me too.
You serious?
Odessa, Texas.
I don't know anyone from Odessa, Texas.
You don't?
No, I heard of it. People make fun of it. And that's kind of my standard joke. They say, you know, where are you from? I say, from Odessa, west of Dallas. And then, you know,
okay.
Yeah.
Have you ever been there?
No. Is there anything there? I mean,
not really.
No.
It's out in the middle of nowhere. I actually am really happy I grew up there. It's the Friday Night Lights school is there. Permian High School is what, you know, Friday Night Lights, the series, the high school football thing.
Oh, okay.
A book was written about my high school because it has this amazing high school football program
where these
kids were like superstars because there's
nothing else
going on
right
there.
And they probably got rewarded greatly.
They were
the superstars.
That's one of the fascinating things about the book. That book is that these kids, they're kids. How did they handle being like heroes in the town?
Sure.
And the rest of their life, a lot of them, that experience, it never lives up to that experience.
Yeah, it's hard.
It's fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
So anyways, and one of the things growing up, people always said that somehow it was named after Odessa because of there were like Russians working on the railroad that came through there, and that they named it after their hometown in the middle of a desert in the middle of nowhere. and your Odessa
is a beautiful city. It's on the Black Sea.
It's on the sea. It's a seaport.
It's gorgeous. Yeah. It's
Have you been back there, by the way?
I've been
recently.
I've been back only one time in 1990. Showtime wanted me to do a special, and Yaakov Smirnoff from Moscow, Idaho. That was the name of the special. So I shot some of it in Moscow, Russia, and then some of it in Odessa, and then came to Idaho, and Odessa was much friendlier and nicer.
Than Moscow.
Yeah.
Well, Idaho's interesting.
Yeah. But you know, it turned out really good.
So that has been the last time. I mean, is there anything about it that you miss other than the fact, I know you obviously have relatives there.
Yes, I do. And actually, I am going back this September, and I work in the Regent Cruise Line, and they kind of let me pick where I want to go. So I perform there, and then I go to places where I really like. And so Odessa was one of them, but because of the challenges in Ukraine, they changed the routing to Greek Isles. So I have to tough it out in Greek Isles.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know. and so, but I already bought tickets for my kids to come join me in Odessa. And so I'm going to fly from Istanbul to Odessa and spend a few days there with my relatives and introduce my kids to them.
Now, how have they viewed you over there over the years? Were you like public enemy number one at one point because you had, I mean, were they even aware of you
actually,
during
I,
your heyday
actually,
in the 80s?
As far as I know, and I'm happy to tell you because
yes.
otherwise I might not be sitting here telling you this, I don't think I was on their radar.
Not at all.
They were busy with hunger.
Oh.
And those are priorities.
Okay,
you know?
So they were preoccupied.
Yeah, and so
they weren't thinking about the American comedian Yakov. They were thinking
food.
Yeah, where's
bread?
My bread coming
yeah, exactly,
from? All right,
exactly,
I get that.
Yeah. So it was distraction worked. They did not go after me. Yeah.
Now, what about now? Are they more aware of what you've done? And
honestly, I don't keep track.
No?
I don't call Putin on a regular basis. Said. Are you aware of me now yet? You shot one guy by Kremlin. Do you need another target? What would you like? I don't do that.
Yeah. All right. That's probably a good idea.
Yeah. It's smart. They don't know about me. I don't need the market. America is enough for me.
So you've told me about how you deal with your act now. And again, this was part of Marin's podcast, and I'll stop talking about him because he doesn't need the publicity. you had this amazing career that came out. I watched your Miller Lite commercial the other day.
I was just
trying to kind of catch up on all the things because I remember seeing you at one point all the time.
It seemed that way, yeah.
Every talk show, you were in the Miller Lite commercial. I was on a lot, during sports and stuff.
Yes.
You were very high profile. Everybody kind of knew who you were and knew what your act was and knew the catchphrase. It was everywhere.
What a country,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, there we go.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what it was?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it was. Yeah, I still remember it.
Do you? But you're saying that you kind of, the expectation when you go on stage, like when you go up at the Comedy Store here, which you've been doing a bit lately.
Yes.
You kind of have to deal with that, not in a nostalgic way. You're not bringing out the hits. But you have to
address
recognize it, right?
You have to address it.
Yeah.
However, I think I'm starting to recognize you and I had this conversation a little bit ago, and I'm starting to recognize it could be possibly that it's my own desire to explain where I was. And I had a conversation actually with a friend not too long ago who... She came to see my show, and she said, do you really need to tell them all of the things that you've done or some crime? She said, because as far as the audience was concerned, and she said, I was there with another three people who were, we enjoyed your new show, and we really didn't need the older stuff, which was kind of a good confirmation because, like, the PBS special that I'm doing will not have any older stuff in it. And they're intrigued with the new brand or new slogan, Happily Ever Laughter,
right.
Is what I'm all about now. And so I think it might have been some inertia on my part that I felt like I was responsible to explain where I was for the last 24 years,
right? Well, that's basically what you did when you built your theater in Branson, I guess, which is you kind of had to straddle the old and the new because people probably expected
totally,
that.
Totally.
Was all about kind of like bring us, do the hits.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And they actually, they don't really know when they're coming to see my show, even now, like I'm going to be there October and November. They're coming for the old brand. They're not even aware of the new brand. But I give them about 10 minutes of that and of the older brand, and then I take them on the journey about happiness and laughter. And they're, because it's about them more, it's something that they can go and take home and actually implement is to have more joy and more laughter in their lives. They embrace that very quickly. I don't have to convince them.
So you've talked before about how, because you were there, it's so strange to say this, you were there at the Berlin Wall when it was coming down.
Yes.
You were there with Bob Hope,
you talked about
recently.
Yeah.
You're hacking away at the thing.
Yes,
taking chunks off the hammers,
yeah.
And you have joked about how at this very same time the wall was going down,
my career was coming with it.
Yeah.
I mean, the writing was on the wall. I was hacking at it, but I didn't see the writing. The writing says get a new job, you know, get a daytime job.
How soon after basically the Cold War, you know, petering away, how soon did you recognize you had to kind of reinvent yourself? Or did you think, oh, no, it's comedy's done? Did you have
actually,
that thought?
Not when I was there hammering away. No,
not at the time.
I just, because I the thought didn't even occur to me literally till David Letterman had this top 10 list on the night when the Soviet Union collapsed. And he said, you know, number one will be Yakov Smirnov will be out of work. Mm-hmm. And at that moment, when my father-in-law laughed, it made me look back and go, no way. You know, there's, I mean, I'm still funny. It's nothing changed.
Right.
Well, the perception changed. The perception that I was the release of stress for America from the Soviet Russia no longer was necessary.
Well, you had done such an excellent job of branding yourself as this guy.
Yeah.
And people were loving that comedy and loving the character you had created.
Yes.
And then to and have to get to know you as something else was, we Americans don't like to try something new.
Well, and also try this on for size, getting me to get to know me as something else was also pretty scary.
Well, that's what I wanted to get to, is not so much that you suddenly felt like, oh, I can't get work or I can't get a job, but who am I?
That was the motivator.
Sure.
That was really, how do I feed my family? I mean, I had two little kids, and it was like, holy, it wasn't altruistic to begin with. Let me discover myself while I'm sitting on my yacht and traveling the Mediterranean. No. It was like, holy crap, my contracts are not renewed, and I don't have... we had $2.5 million home in Pacific Palisades. It was like the mortgage was still due, and it was like... And time was ticking. All of a sudden, it's like, American dream was crumbling in my mind. How do I do this? And I tried to do comedy clubs, and I wasn't selling a lot of tickets. So it was like going to Branson was my last resort. Mm-hmm. And I realized they don't know the Soviet Union collapsed. And and I'm like, hey, I got another 25 years here.
They weren't getting papers in the Ozarks? They weren't getting that stuff delivered? Or maybe they just weren't reading?
They weren't reading. No, the papers were there, yeah. But I'll tell you, the blessing in disguise was this, that this is a community of people who work really hard and really don't pay attention to major trends in the popular media. They don't. So if you fit their model, which is clean, family, patriotic, you know, it's very rare. It's almost like they're stuck like in the 50s or whatever, you know. And I fit that. Fit that. So they embraced me. It took a little while. It wasn't like immediate big score there, because I wasn't like planning this. It was just an emergency landing. And then realizing that they like me there, and little by little it became a big success. Now I own 2,000 seat theater, and I entertain over 4 million people. And if you would have, in my high school yearbook, it was not on, you know, say more likely to entertain people in Branson. You know, no. But
did you have a high school yearbook, Yakov?
No.
Well, pamphlet, anything?
No.
Okay.
No. But thanks for asking. No.
Because I'd love to see those pictures if you've got them.
No. Yeah.
You on the basketball team, the Odessa.
Yeah, Odessa basketball. Yeah.
So Branson takes off. That's a success. Again, maybe certainly not what you expected, and maybe not even what you wanted, but it definitely gave you a toehold into saying, okay, absolutely, I can still entertain.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, how did the connection, what at what point did you decide, I'm going to go learn something new and travel in this direction that took you to Penn? I don't see where that connected at all.
No. And it wasn't that obvious. It was first 2-3 years were very much establishing myself in Branson and doing my routines that I've done for years and so. And then my marriage was falling apart. And that's where this
was
whole,
distance? Was were you
no,
guys?
No, she was there with me and the kids were there. Yeah. And the stress of that was part of it. However, there was more things that were happening that were kind of taking us, maybe because I was working so much to establish the business. It's hard to say. There wasn't anything definite like alcohol or none of that. There was no infidelity. There was nothing there except we were just growing apart and the kids were growing up. And I was realizing that we were not laughing together. Mm-hmm. We were not. Unfortunately, we went through a lot of marriage counseling, tried to fix it, but didn't know how. It wasn't working. And then we both decided that, you know, it's not healthy for the children to see this and think that this is what happiness is. So we decided that this was kind of a model that I haven't heard, but we agreed to stay married as parents to our children, but get a divorce as a husband and wife,
interesting,
which is kind of unusual, but it felt like we're going to do our best there, but we need to split because we weren't happy.
In hindsight, do you think that was the wise thing to do? Or
Yes, I do.
Because there are... adults, there are couples who stay together and they say it's for the kids.
Yeah.
And you know, kids are very intuitive. I came from a broken home.
Yeah.
I was one of those kids that was very happy when my parents split up because it was obvious to me I was 11 or 12. I wasn't a little kid, but it was obvious to me these two people didn't belong together.
No.
And everybody was much happier when they weren't together.
Yeah.
But there was that effort to, well, let's not disrupt the children.
Correct. Yeah. And we tried that too at first, but then we realized that it was just not, mm-hmm, not working. And I'm not taking it lightly. It was a very difficult time.
Sure.
Very difficult time. However, that's what got me to on the path of recognizing something, that there is a specific order that happens, and it happens unconsciously. We're not necessarily planning this. But when we do fall in love with our significant other or future spouse, a lot of happiness, a lot of laughter happens. Mm-hmm. And then that I asked this question over 4 million people in my theater, and they all remember that. People just remember that happy time, right? And scientists have proven this, that it lasts about a year, and it's hormonally driven, and Mother Nature has very specific intention for that. It's for us to procreate.
Mm-hmm.
So we laugh, we make love, everything is happy and joyful, and that's like nature's free introductory offer.
Oh,
yeah,
nice.
And then you got to pay full price.
Oh,
but nobody,
yeah,
there's no disclosure. It's a small print, right?
I just clicked agreed because I was so looking forward to that first part. Yeah.
Exactly.
I didn't put a note on my calendar that said,
no, check later.
Check to see if you would like to cancel.
No, exactly.
Of course not.
So that happens to everyone, right?
Right.
And so then you move in together, you live together, you marry, and then when you get into a situation when you're getting divorced, it's the reverse. Laughter, this first thing that goes. Second thing goes your intimacy. Third thing goes your house. In that order.
Yeah.
So once it started happening, at first I thought I was kind of in my own vacuum because I thought, well, I got married later in life. I thought I, you know, done all the homework that I needed to do to be able to sustain a happy relationship forever. That was the intent. She did the same. And yet something went wrong. So this is where my comedic mind and engineer mind, because my dad was an engineer, so there was like, I want to deconstruct this. I want to understand the process that happened here and happens for millions and millions of people. The more I started looking at this, how overwhelming it was. The divorce rate is like 57% on the average. I just heard another figure that people who are getting married before 22 years old, their divorce rate is like 90%.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's like, so something is not right. And it's interesting. It's like, as a comedian, I can have a show with, let's say, 300 jokes that go right, but one joke did not go right. I will zoom in on that joke because I need to understand why. Because there's only three ingredients in every joke. You can look at every paper. It's setup, punchline, laugh.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And so three ingredients. One of those ingredients is wrong. It ain't going to happen.
Right, right.
Actually, it's just two ingredients to get the laugh, right? So if the laugh is not happening,
then one of those two is messed up.
Messed up. So then I start applying that simple formula, and that's what I continue doing. I start applying that formula saying, okay, so it's setup or punchline. It's one of those two in, let's say, in intimacy or in sexual relationship. It's foreplay and act, and then there's orgasm. So those three steps repeating. If you look at successful businesses, they satisfy the need of the customer, and then they apply humor if they want laughter.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Salespeople do that. Politicians do that. Preachers do that. You know, hosts of talk show, podcast,
right,
whatever.
Yeah.
All of us do the same thing. It's a 1-2 punch. 1-2 punch.
Yeah. And there's an element of, it's interesting, there's an element of communication there. It's saying something and understanding what you're going to get back from saying that thing. I mean, as you kind of boil it down to something very simple, I'm recognizing that kind of you as a comedian, for instance, if you're using that analogy, that you know that the audience wants to laugh.
Yes.
But you need to give them the opening to do that.
Absolutely.
And it's such a back and forth, as is a relationship, as is any business, you know, kind
transaction.
Of relation. Yeah.
Everywhere. It's everywhere. So I was looking for that common denominator, mm-hmm. so I was zooming in on this, and that's where I decided, listen, I'm spending all of this energy anyway on research.
Right.
Why not have help from Ivy League schools? So I applied, and Martin Seligman, who is a leading professor in positive psychology, he was just starting his new endeavor, which was the master's program, and he was open to have me in the master's this program. And I
now where had you studied before?
My bachelor's is in Odessa,
right.
And it was in art. I'm teacher of art. That was my bachelor's degree. So I wasn't really planning to go into psychology, but because I was so, I mean, it started from pain, literally pain of divorce and pain of not understanding why, because so many answers out there, but I wanted to know, no. I did everything by the book. I did everything that I knew how. It says happily ever after, and then there is no book of how to sustain that. So that's the chapter, that's a book after that.
Have you always been this analytical about kind of, you know, your comedy and your career and then in the relationship where you have, is that the way you've always looked at things? You have kind of like this schematic that you've
written? I think so. I think so. When you look at Myers-Briggs profile or, you know, any testings, Martin Seligman had this great test that I highly recommend for everybody to take. It's called It's authentichappiness.org, and you can take it for free, test. And it's virtues in action. And basically, it's defining what are your strong suit, what are your strengths that you're actually using on an everyday basis and you don't even know you are. And you answer like 100 questions or something like that, and then the score comes up. And mine, surprisingly, I thought it would be sense of humor would be like top. It wasn't. It was number 11. Number one was ingenuity, originality, and inventiveness. So to answer the question, yes, that's how my brain works. It's that, and I believe that I structure jokes like that and act and whatever I've done, I just put them together or deconstruct them and put them back in a different way. That's what I do.
Well, comedians are complicated people. I mean, I really don't think, going by that test, that since, you know who has sense of humor? It's that guy at work that's, you know, making the joke
the cooler,
and has the wacky toys on his desk.
Yeah.
Oh, that's me. I have toys on my desk. But he's not necessarily a comedian. He's just a funny guy around the office. Comedians are very interesting creatures.
Skillful, yeah.
Well, but they're all, and you know, you.
Oh, I agree.
Seinfeld is somebody who's
a machine.
Yeah, he analyzes comedy in the least funny way I've ever heard.
But he's brilliant. In terms, like, when I would work with him, it would be like he would stop the car, you know, if we're going, you know, stop the car, something funny happens, he would stop it, write it down in details, very, very specific, very, and it shows. I mean, look at the success.
Yeah, so I can see you kind of starting to kind of pick apart the relationship and how that, because also part of it is, it's just like telling a joke that's not working and trying to figure out, do I get rid of it or do I perfect it.
Fix it.
Yeah. And you wanted answers. You didn't want to go into another relationship and have that same thing happen.
Absolutely.
But you didn't want to just kind of fly in the face of, you know, I'll figure it out somehow. You wanted to break it down.
I wanted to know, I'm like a mechanic, what went wrong and is going wrong for millions of people. It wasn't just me. I'm like going, wow. And I found so many correlation that really apply to everyone, literally everyone. It's different for each couple or each relationship. However, the umbrella of what creates that setup and what creates that punchline is the same for everyone.
So you get into University of Pennsylvania, master's program.
Yes.
It's a psychology program.
Yes.
Apparently, the credits from Odessa transferred somehow.
They did.
That's great.
Yeah, surprise. I mean, I was surprised.
Yeah.
But
I'm glad you didn't have to go take like a semester of freshman comp or something.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you. Yeah.
Did you immediately kind of feel like you were in a? I mean, did you enjoy it? Was it hard?
Yes.
Did you just take right to it immediately?
It wasn't easy because I had to commute. I was doing shows in Branson and commuting from Branson to Philadelphia.
How are you doing that?
It was executive. They call it executive course. So you do a lot of it online, and then you fly in for a long weekend for like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then fly back on Sunday. So I did because I owned the theater, I could adjust my schedule to be able to.
You could set your schedule.
Yeah. So I did that for the whole program and didn't miss any classes and was able to do my dissertation, everything. And my work was because I wanted to stay on track. I wanted to prove that if people are laughing together, like in the initial stages, they will want to go out, you know, to get, you know, they will want a date.
Mm-hmm.
So my job was to monitor dating services, like speed dating. So I would go to different states and do that, you know, and
oh my God, you're getting data and probably amazing material at the same
time.
It
was funny, but it was interesting that it wasn't correct. My assumption was not correct.
What was your assumption?
My assumption was that if they're laughing together and you're watching them laugh, they will
form a bond. Yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't.
No?
It was no. It wasn't happening. It was a lot of nervous laughter happening,
which is not real laughter.
It wasn't.
That's forced,
yeah, exactly,
right?
Okay. Exactly.
That makes sense.
And so that didn't work out. But what did come out from that research was that women laugh double the amount of time that men do in those scenarios. So men are like peacocks. In their courtship is their sense of humor. It's what they do to get the female to laugh.
Mm-hmm.
The unfortunate part that if she's not interested, she'll laugh, but then it's still a no. You know, so he's trying, but it's still a no. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So, but that was my work for master's degree. What I'm hoping to do in my PhD program is a lot deeper and a lot more interesting, is to actually to because there is a, I guess, William James, father of American psychology, stated that I don't create happiness because I don't create laughter because I'm happy. If I'm laughing, that creates happiness. And I want to do research to show the other way, that it actually, that happiness happens first and laughter is a result of that. So it will take a little bit of
Because I'm thinking, you know, all I have to relate it to is my relationship, and I've basically been in one, thank goodness, one good one for the mm-hmm. longest time, mm-hmm. and the only one really mm-hmm. I've been in. But it seems to me that it, maybe the speed dating thing was the mistake, that it really is something creates a connection, but the actual love, the deeper bond, probably does come from when there is a kind of a more genuine
absolutely.
Laughter
absolutely.
With each other. When you're and I also wonder too, how much of it is like some sort of primitive thing, male, female, and how much of it is a societal thing? Like you say, the women laugh more.
Yes.
How much of that is that women have been just told that
condition.
That they need to give you validation as the male.
You know what? I don't know if that's being conditioned into it. I don't know.
You don't
if
think
that's.
So?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But here's the stats that when I was doing this research, like eHarmony had like 10 million subscribers, right?
Right.
And the number one quality that they want from their mate, number one quality by far,
this
is sense of
this
humor.
This is female?
Both.
Oh,
both
okay.
Men
oh,
and women.
Okay.
Number one quality, sense of humor. But when you define it, women want a man who will make them laugh, and men want somebody who will laugh at their jokes. So I don't know. I think it's more of a primal response, similar in like intimacy and sexual response. The woman's, we're craving that woman's response of her enjoying herself. That's what motivates us.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was the other way around, it doesn't seem like it would be ideal.
Right. And again, this we're talking in very broad terms here about but you know, sometimes all of that kind of makes sense. By the way, this is just a random thought. It just occurred to me. But how much of your research as it continues might involve same-sex couples and how that translates?
It's the same.
It's
the same. Yeah, because the formula that I am because in same-sex couples, they're very specific from my limited amount of conversations. If they're a gay couple, most of the time they assigned their kind of a masculine, feminine.
There's almost a gender role.
Very,
there.
Very quickly. Yeah. Very quickly. In the first date, they don't, you know, even though they're the same, you know, physical body structure, they very specific about who is going to be who. And then that's how they...
As in a slightly more dominant personality and a slightly more passive
correct.
Personality, but they're
correct.
Still... interesting.
Yeah. It's a yin and yang, and they need to be able to have that. So it's more verbalized than now with the heterosexual couples. it could be a man that looks like a man, but he really is more in a passive role.
Yeah.
And a woman could be more in the dominant role. So,
oh, I know couples like that.
But the umbrella that I'm looking at mm-hmm. doesn't involve that. It doesn't really care about that. The umbrella is, what's the setup? What's the punchline?
Right.
The setup is really for everyone to create laughter. In my opinion, is to meet the other person's needs. And it starts from when we're little babies. We have three modes that we can be in when we don't speak, right? We can be neutral mode, or we can be laughing or crying. Crying says, please meet my needs.
Right.
Laughing means I'm happy. The neutral state is like everything is met. I'm ready for laughter or crying. Yeah. Whatever, either way. Yeah. I can go either way.
It's a tipping point, right.
Yeah. But so that's where I want to do research. Yeah. I want to actually, I'm talking to people at USC and UCLA to do this study. It shouldn't be very difficult to show that as a building block of our being, as our primal needs, if our needs are met, we're in a neutral position. And then applying sense of humor, which we all have because I can prove that with 4 million people saying during the honeymoon stage, they all experienced laughter. Mm-hmm. So somebody had a sense of humor.
You're right. Right. Right.
And most of them do. It's just the needs are not met any longer. So when we stop meeting the other person's needs, which we do in the honeymoon stage, so it's like I said, free introductory offer. And then later we go, see you later because I got to work or I got to do other things and I don't take you, you're not as important as you were during the honeymoon stage. That's why laughter is going away. So once you're aware of that, that's your choice. Most of people are not aware. Once I became aware of recognizing this, it's now my choice. How do I treat my relationships?
Right.
Whether it's my child, whether it's my work, whether it's my beloved, I choose to put that energy into it, and then laughter is there.
It seems like it has to be mutual too. It needs to go both ways. You can do everything you can to kind of bring the laughter back. It's not about telling jokes. You and I have talked about this.
Not.
It's not about putting the fake dog poo down on the floor.
Yeah,
which is hilarious.
Hilarious. If her needs are met.
Right.
If her needs are not met.
If she's not looking for fake dog poo.
She's not even looking for it. If you've done there, and your listeners done that, when, you're trying to make a joke mm-hmm. to fix something, and she looks at you going, no, you really?
Yeah.
Are you serious? Are you? No.
Right. So it's not the laughter that repairs. It's meeting.
Yes. You're correct. Keep going.
It's not the laughter that can repair things. It's meeting each other's needs that results in the fact that it's easier to laugh again, that you can find those things.
It's a setup.
Yeah.
The setup. Try to have sex without foreplay. We all try that, and we know where that ends up, right? So you need to see.
Well, one of us doesn't have a good time, that's for sure.
Yeah, but you see what happens. Those are the very obvious things that meeting somebody needs, understanding what they need. They're not necessarily telling you what they need. All of those things are much more complex. I'm not saying it's easy.
Right.
But if you're not even aware that that's what's supposed to happen, then you get farther and farther and farther apart because it's so painful to keep coming to something that's not working. And then the solution, I didn't know where to go.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, after a while you go, well, it's better not to hurt anymore.
Right, right. I mean, that's again, when you put it in the simplest terms, when you understand that all you're doing is just extending pain and discomfort, no two people should ever have to live that way.
It shouldn't, but it would be nice to know why it happened.
Right. How did academia respond to a comedian coming in with this
good
idea
question,
that they wanted to?
Good question.
I mean, there must have been They looked. It must have looked at you a little bit sideways.
Yeah. Some people like Martin Seligman was very embracing because he is established very funny himself. I mean, as you know, and him and I had this intense discussions. Like, you know, he would say, "Well, I think, you know, laughter comes first, and then love follows." And I would say, well, that's true. However, love needs to be there before even laughter happens to begin with. And he said, that doesn't make sense. I said, well, what's your research on this? And he said, well, you remember you gave me your DVD and from your Broadway show? I said, yes. And he said, I showed it to my wife. And we watched it together, and she laughed, and then I got laid. And I said, that's research? And he goes, as good as it needs to be for me. And I go, wait, but you don't see something that happened that you brought the DVD home. You didn't watch it by yourself. You came home, and you spent an hour together,
right,
sitting on the couch, connecting. And laughter was a part of it, yes, but you did it. You met her needs. You were home. You showed up versus being in the lab somewhere doing experiments. You were home. That's what I'm trying to say. At that point, I wasn't strong enough, I guess, to argue with my professor, you know, but I needed a little bit more
information.
But
you had ideas. I mean, especially from somebody, if you have been throughout your career as analytical as you admit that you are,
yes,
that this is stuff that's been going on in your head the whole time.
Yeah.
And then it translated to what was going on in your personal relationship. And then you saw the connection between those things.
Yes.
And really, it's just you with the need for knowledge to go, I really want to pick this apart and understand it and obviously share it, because you want to find a way to kind of take this in a relatable way that takes it outside of the Ivy League, outside of the academia, outside of the stats. To
the people who are getting divorces every day, you know, that's what who I want to help.
Yeah.
And my children and everybody who can hear it and say, so I just need to focus back on that. You know, somebody told me a cute story yesterday, a gentleman that I had lunch with, and he said, you know, I was working a lot, and he's a speaker, and so he travels a lot, and he said he came home, and his wife at one point said, we need to talk, and he realizes that something is off, you know, and she said, I know how passionate you are about your work, I know how you light up, but I didn't marry you, so I don't see you.
Right.
And he said, and we were discussing, like, so was there humor there that fixed the situation, or was there? And he said, well, the good news, you at least want me home, right?
Right.
And she laughed, and he saw it as a laughter fixed it. And I said, no, what fixed it is how you responded to her request.
Mm-hmm.
What fixed it that you didn't say, well, you like the big house you live in, so you'll have to see me as many times as I show up. Whatever. He didn't do that. He said, so I'm glad you want me home. And she laughed, and everything was okay after that.
Right.
So I'm saying it's a very subtle thing that we're dealing with here, because we all experienced it. But very easy to for most people that I tell it to, they go, well, so if I just can make her laugh, then it's all fine. No. You're meeting her needs is what's going to make her fine. And vice versa, the same for a guy.
Because what are we doing when we come to a comedy club? We don't just come to laugh. There is a deeper need that we have when we go into
big
those
time.
Places.
Yes.
And can
releasing
you define that?
The stress.
We're escaping from
big
other
time.
Stuff,
yes.
Right?
We know that this will give us something that will take us out of the reality, right?
Mm-hmm.
And movies do that and all of that. So it's not just laughter that does it.
Right.
However, the comedy club is a great example. What is the need that's being met? And I think the need is to relate to topics, whatever they're on stage, that are going to be presented. And they're presented variety of topics, from a relationship to eating habits to racial problems to whatever it is. But you know that the release, the setup will be, I'm meeting your needs in this particular topic, and I'm going to apply my unique sense of humor to get you to laugh. Once you laugh, it's an agreement that you agree and I agree that we transaction is completed.
Right.
Let's move on to the next transaction. Right. And then it's the next setup, next punchline, and a release. And that's what people come for. But it's, I'm not proud to say this, but we're kind of like, we're substitute. We're not, we're like strippers in a nightclub with a pole in the middle, and we're doing this. So we're hoping to release enough stress so you get home and connect to one another. But ultimately...
Well, it's no mistake. I mean, it's no secret, I guess, that, you know, comedy clubs, that's a date thing. I mean, it's almost always... I mean, wouldn't it be like 75, 80, 90% couples that
totally.
Go in there?
Totally. And all the stats will back it up with, you know, with dopamine and the oxytocin and all of those hormones that make you feel fuzzy and happy and joyful, end up in something more, hopefully.
So you're moving on to get your PhD, right?
Yeah.
Dr. Yakov.
Yeah.
Boy,
yeah.
I don't know how to deal with that. I'm having trouble processing that.
Really?
Dr. Yakov.
Yeah.
Would you ever go into like the private sector and like do therapy?
No. That's not. No, I see myself as a stand-up neuroscientist, you know? I mean, there's many of those, you know?
No, yeah, there's not. That is a term that's never been said in the history of words.
but now you heard it. And I see myself to be able to take, and you describe it very well, to apply it, really, to give people a simple version of it. It's not that difficult. Because when I listen to scientists talk about laughter, it's horrendous.
I had to read Freud and the, what is it, Freud and the something of jokes. I mean, it was just, it's the, obviously not meant to be a hilarious book.
No.
But the analysis of humor and why we laugh. And it's fascinating, but...
Yeah, wow. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, page turner. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, no, you're right. So my job is to gift wrap this knowledge because it's not that complex. What I'm saying, it's not that difficult. We all experience it. We just did not know what we did right.
Right. Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
Now,
we can usually pinpoint the things we screw up. But it's much harder to actually figure out.
What did we do right?
Yeah.
I bought, you know, I mean, it's simple things. Bought flowers, wrote a little note. Things like that that we did.
The communication you were talking about.
Absolutely. Yeah. Be able to look at, just sit down and listen. We used to listen to women. I mean, we used to, like, during the honeymoon stage, we trick them. We listen. and they think we're going to do that later.
Yes.
We don't. We just zone out. I mean, she starts talking, and we're looking at the cabinet door behind her, thinking, well, I can fix that, but I can't fix what she's talking about, and I don't want to be here. That's what she needs. She just wants to. It's a very clever thing, because women really need to empty out. They feel so full with all the information that they get through the day, that we're like a garbage can, really. They just want to dump this stuff.
Women love to share. Yeah, I mean, it's the joke of sharing your feelings. Men never share your feelings.
But to them, it's a necessity because they're overwhelmed. They're literally overwhelmed. And my advice to men is, like, if you want to put something in, help her take something out. I mean, that's. It's that simple.
You gotta make some room.
Huh?
Make some room.
You got to.
Oh, that's good advice, Yakov. Dr. Yakov.
Well, not yet.
I'm just trying to get used to it. This is great stuff. I'm kind of connecting to you when we first started talking, simply because the idea of reinventing yourself as men of a certain age. I mean, I feel like that's one thing I wanted to get into a little bit, too, is that you really did have a point in your life where you had to decide, like you were talking about with the Branson thing, there was a move out of necessity, mm-hmm. but then there was a move out of genuine thirst for knowledge and an ultimate goal that maybe you didn't even know what it was, but
not.
You wanted a yeah. deeper understanding, and you must have thought, this will manifest itself in some way. I just don't know exactly what yet.
It was totally selfish first to understand for me mm-hmm. why laughter died. Why?
Right.
And then recognition that no one done this research. Nobody understands it from where the way I'm thinking. So then it becomes part of like, well, I want to let everybody know. And it becomes, because you're spending all this energy on doing this anyway, and you start writing routines because that's what comedians do. Mm-hmm. We put everything up on stage. And then the audience kind of says, oh, really? I didn't know that. And they are laughing and encouraging. And that's mm-hmm. that becomes like, you know, really... exciting thing, and watching the body language of the couples also very interesting, because they come to show and they're preoccupied with the outside world and they're like disconnected. You could feel it as they're walking in kind of single line to behind one another. And then as the show progresses, as they're hearing, they're recognizing their stories in my presentation, and recognizing that there is hope and there is laughter and there's joy and things that they did like so much yeah. and don't know how to get back. You could feel their energy. They're leaning towards one another, and you can almost like see for the show as their hands, they hold hands, and then as they're walking out kind of smiling and joy. And to me, it's a huge reward.
Maybe you've, yeah, I mean, in some of those cases, maybe you've just opened the door a little bit to them to reconnect.
Absolutely.
When they weren't before.
Totally.
Cool stuff, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's exciting to watch it progress.
Yeah.
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 Is there anything, tell me, let's talk about the PBS special real quick,
yes.
because I don't know the details on that. So tell the world.
The PBS is doing this special, that my special called Happily Ever Laughter. And we're going to film it September 25th, and then it's going to air in March. And this will be kind of a first significant recognition of a new direction of Yaakov, even though it's been tested and tried on 4 million people. Now it's finally going to be, the baby is going to be released or relieved. No, that's the wrong one. shown to the world.
Yes.
Like a royal baby, whatever.
Like
you
the
know.
Lion King above that, at the, on top of the cliff.
There you go. Yeah.
That's exciting.
Yeah, so it is exciting.
Well, this is good stuff. Yeah. Well, it's really been fun to get to know you, Yaakov. And I also just... You know, just watching, again, I feel this connection in terms of kind of having a new phase in life and embracing new ideas and new
yes.
things, and I'm,
yes.
which is what I'm trying to do, too.
I think it keeps you strong, young. You have purpose and
yeah.
and fascination. To me, that word is just, I highly recommend everybody to look at that word. What fascinates you is what drives you, what really, it's more than passion. It's just... It's fascinating to me, like to get into a laboratory and look at the brain and what lights up and what doesn't. And it's fascinating. So that's what I want to do.
So now that you've got this new focus
mm-hmm.
and you do have a present and a future kind of in mind.
Yes.
How do, when you look back, which you must reflect now and you have some distance, what do you think of those days when things went bananas, when you were kind of at this peak in the stand-up world and had all these things happening? What's your relationship with that Yaakov like right now?
I think I'm at peace with all of that. I'm seeing that you know, I can look at it from practical standpoint and say, okay, I'm a survivor and I got out of Russia and then I came to Hollywood, and so those are like different lives in a way. I had 26 years in Russia, then I had 13 or some years in Hollywood, then 25 to 40 years in Branson. And this is just another evolution of Yaakov. That's a practical stand. The understand is like I think there's a divine intervention with all of this, in my opinion, that got me out of Russia, got me to Hollywood, got me to Branson, to where in Branson the energy is spent totally different than in Hollywood. Hollywood is like you got to keep going north or south on 405. You got to keep going. I mean, and I don't know where everybody's going, but they're going somewhere.
Yes.
In Branson, they're going nowhere. They really don't. So it's like time stands still. You do good work. You still in show business there, but you don't compete with other people. You don't. It gave me a cocoon where I could become what I'm going to kind of expose in
without this. Expectations from anybody else to
no
fulfill anything.
It was
to guide it.
Yeah. My own evolution. Yeah, my own evolution. So did it happen by chance? Nah, I don't know. I believe there's a bigger picture than that.
All right. Quick questions, quick answers.
Yes.
Funniest person you ever saw on stage?
Robin Williams, by far.
And how often did you see him go up?
As often as I could. Yeah, I mean, the comedy store, it would be like he would. I mean, it depends. He would just show up, and whenever he would show up, he would go up, and by far.
Consistently the funniest person you ever saw.
Pretty much so, yeah. The Jerry Seinfeld, followed by Jerry. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who is
and Richard Pryor. Okay, sorry. Yeah, and that was probably
you couldn't
gone.
Have been there at a better time.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it was.
What about the funniest person you ever saw that not enough people remember the name or know the name?
Oh boy.
I'll tell you why I asked that because Jeff Altman was on the podcast not too long ago, and he mentioned Tim Thomerson, who was somebody I hadn't thought of in forever.
Yeah.
But he said he was a comedian's comedian. He was the guy that all the comedians would talk about.
There's a lady that you and I got to meet, Debbie Guderis, mm-hmm. Who is hilarious comedian, and I think she needs to be a lot more in the spotlight.
Yeah, excellent. What's your favorite joke you ever told? Was there one that either you just had an affection for or one that just killed every single time?
Probably the one that I, I've been telling that joke for many, many years, and I continue to find it to be probably the most well-structured joke. It's when I was growing up, we lived in a communal apartment and with 9 other families. And when my parents wanted to make love, they would send me to look out the window. And then my dad would say, so what do you see in the window? And I said, our neighbors making love. And he said, how can you tell? I said, because their son is looking at me. And I still find that to be the most consistent, the most, it very well structured.
It's got some, it paints a picture is what it does. It's a great
setup,
theater of the mind.
Punchline,
laugh. How true was that, by the way?
Well, the one window is true. In terms of my parents making love in front of me.
A little embroidery on
that
one.
Yeah, a little bit, exaggeration.
And finally, have you learned enough personally that you feel like in your own relationship, have you cracked the code a little bit? Do you think?
Yeah, I do. I do feel that way. However, it's a work in progress. Yeah. It will never, if anybody's, kind of thinking that this is it's like the weather. You might have a satellite that will say, hey, bring the umbrella.
Right.
It won't change the weather. So that's all I'm saying. I just want a satellite to be able to see what's coming. And if tsunami is coming, I don't want to be in Japan, So that's all I'm saying.
All right. It's been a pleasure. This has been great. I look forward to, you know, maybe doing this again at some point when you've got further knowledge that I can steal from you.
No stealing necessary. I'll give it very generously.
Jakob, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Get a monkey. Get a monkey!
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.